October generally when they would be out doing that. I bring you good tidings of great joy. One is born, Christ the Lord, what they said. The sign that the shepherd would see, a babe wrapped in swaddling clothes lying in a manger. And so the shepherd decided to go with haste to see the young child, the baby, and they did. Came back and glorified God because of it. Then, following right behind that in Luke chapter 2, we have the circumcision of Jesus. Or the circumcision going back to the covenant with Abraham back in Genesis 17, that God first made with him. We stated it as part of the law of Moses, of course. But for their 8 days old, the circumcision and also the naming of the child. And of course, the angel that told both Mary and Joseph his name would be Jesus. 40 days after the birth of a male child, the mother was to offer an offering of purification, a lamb, if you couldn't do that, 2 turtle doves or 2 young pigeons. And so Joseph and Mary go to the temple for that purpose, to offer that sacrifice. While they're there, they run into this old gentleman named Simeon, who had been told by the Holy Spirit that he would not die until he had seen the Lord's anointed, he had seen the Lord's Christ. And so Simeon is there. He takes the child, blesses the child, says he'd be a light to the Gentiles, glory to his people Israel, and says some things about him, and then also tells Mary that your heart also would be pierced as part of this prophecy he makes regarding the child. Also there was an aged prophetess named Anna who was there day and night in the temple, fasting and praying, and she also saw the child and had comments about him. So that ends up with Luke 2, 38 or so, 39, Luke 2, 39, says that they returned to Nazareth, their hometown. We'll talk some more about that in a minute, but think about Luke here now. Luke has already mentioned Nazareth at least 2 times before. The angel appeared to Mary when she was in Nazareth, and then at the beginning of chapter 2, when Caesar Augustus put out the decree that they would be taxed, they left Nazareth and came down to Bethlehem. So, for Luke to say here to Theophilus as he's writing to him, they returned to Nazareth, would be the natural thing because they'd already been in Nazareth and left Nazareth and came down here. Now we're going to separate that from Matthew here in a minute and what he says about it and how he phrases it there. So, jumping out to Matthew chapter 2. Here the great, Matthew 2. After Jesus was born, Bethlehem, in the days of Herod the King, Herod the Great, on the chart we gave out, looking at all the different Herods and how they're used here. We talked a little bit about this word after last time. Last verse of Matthew chapter 1 is where actually Christ was born. One little verse there about it in Matthew. So then after that, some period of time, don't know how long, that's when this next thing is going to occur here in Matthew chapter 2. So what it is the wise men are coming in. The men from the east come in, they've seen this star, they've come to find the Christ to worship him. They come into Jerusalem and ask, where is he born, King of the Jews? And how did Herod react to that? Well, not too good, because who's Herod? Well, he's King of the Jews. Okay. So to have another king of the Jews born would, of course, tread on his territory. So he wants to know where he's going to be born also. So he has the scribes go start searching for it, and they find what's recorded for us in Micah 5:2. It would be in Bethlehem in Judah. We also get the point there about him being from everlasting, the eternal side. So Herod says, okay, you go and find him and come back and tell me so I can go worship him also. So the wise men depart. They follow the star down to Bethlehem and find the child. They fall down and worship the child and bring him gifts. And then they're warned in a dream by God to not go back to Herod, but to return a different way. That's kind of a quick review of what we went through in the last class. So the wise men have been there and visited, and now they have left. And the as far as Luke's concerned, they finished all the things in the temple, completed the law required, and they've gone back to Nazareth. So let's pick up now at where we are. We're just left off with that little review, and we'll hit a little bit of review again, and go to Matthew chapter 2 and move on from there. Okay. The angel appears to Joseph in a dream. He tells Joseph to arise, take the young child and his mother, and flee to Egypt. Stay there until I bring you word, because Herod is going to be out to destroy the young child. So to protect the Christ, to protect the young child, knowing what Herod's going to do, we're going to talk about his reaction in just a minute. Take the young child and get him out and go to Egypt. And the why, we're going to talk about that. Herod is the king. Of course, you're going to tread on his territory. We talk about somebody being called the king of the Jews. So they take off and leave Bethlehem, Jerusalem, and go down to Egypt. Now, back to a little reminder of what we just talked about. Wise men came, they looking for the king of the Jews. And you don't know about me modifying my slides. I mean, these things get changed so many times. I think I'm done with them, and I go back to them again. I think I'm going to pull a thought to kick in. I was looking at it this morning, and this thought hit me. Here he's called king of the Jews, and he has to leave where he is and flee to Egypt because Herod's going to try to kill him because he's the king of the Jews. Jump over to the very end of his life, when he's appeared before Pilate. What's the very thing Pilate asked him about crucifying? Are you the king of the Jews? Are you the king of the Jews? And the two just kind of caught me this morning as I was thinking back through this. Very first part of his life, he flees because the king of the Jews, and now at the end, the crucifixion, that same title. Of course, you know, that's what Pilate puts on the cross. King of the Jews. It's not that important. Okay, so Herod sent the wise men on the Bethlehem, remember, go find the child and come back so I can worship him also. And God sent him back a different way now. So Herod now realizes that he's been stood up. He realizes that he's been deceived, that they're not going to come back, that they're gone some of the way. And so they didn't come back, can't even believe who this child was. So, the text says he is angry. In fact, the text says he is exceedingly angry. Exceedingly angry. Let me read you what commentator Barnes says about this verse. Exceedingly wroth, very angry. He had been disappointed and deceived. He expected to send an executioner and killed Jesus alone. But had the wise men come back and told him where Jesus was, they'd gone and he'd killed him, that'd been it. But since he was disappointed in this, he thought he would accomplish the same thing and be sure to destroy him if he sent forth and put all the children in the place to death. So instead of killing one, Herod's going to react because he's exceedingly angry. Or react, go kill all these children. Here's what he says. This is an illustration of the power of anger. It stops at nothing. If it cannot accomplish just what it wishes, it does not hesitate to go much farther and accomplish much more evil than it at first designed. He had that wicked heart, indulged in anger, knows not where it will end, will commonly commit far more evil than he at first intended. Think about that and us. What happens when we get angry? Do we often do more than we would have done if we stayed calm? When we get angry, do we reach out and lash out and go beyond what we first thought we would do? That's exactly what the commentator is saying Herod did. His intent would have been, as wise men had come back, would go kill one child. They didn't come back, so he got angry, exceedingly angry about it, and he said, I gotta have a new plan, but goes and kills all his children. So he had all the male children in Bethlehem and the districts around Bethlehem. 2 years old and younger put to death. That's pretty angry. That's pretty powerful. A man could go in there and just wipe these people out like that. These youngsters. Jeremiah 31:15 is a prophecy about this. Thus saith the Lord, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted for her children because they are no more. Adam Clark comments on this verse like this. Is Ramah here mentioned in several towns, he says, but his name was situated in the tribe of Benjamin, a few miles from Jerusalem, near the place where Rachel was buried, who here in a beautiful figure of poetry is represented as coming out of her grave, lamenting bitterly for the loss of her children, none of whom were present, heard of you, all been slain or in exile. This is Jeremiah and his prophecy related to this incident here. Rachel weeping for her children. Now, time passed. Joseph married a child in Egypt. So times passed and Herod has died. Herod did not live long past the birth of Christ. Most of his time is before that. So he dies and Joseph has heard that Archelaus, his father, is reigning in Jerusalem, I mean Judea, and so Joseph is told then to go home. By God, that right. Now, you're probably going to catch this. This line's wrong. I left it in here just for teachers. I don't care how many times you go through and put stuff together when you're teaching, sometimes you make a mess. Look at the sequence of events on this slide. See what's wrong with it? Let's do it again. Herod died. Then the angel told Joseph in a dream to go home. Then Joseph, going back, heard that Archelaus is now reigning. And he decided then he could not go back to Judea, to Bethlehem. So he comes and dwells in a city called Nazareth in Galilee. A little sequence of events difference there. So if you're teaching, don't do like I almost did. Make a mess out of things. So let's talk about Nazareth here a minute. When you read it here in Matthew, it's almost like he was going back to Palestine. Because they come back out of Egypt, and well, I can't go back to Bethlehem or Jerusalem because Archelaus is there reigning now. So, like, I'll go to Galilee and find me a city and call Nazareth. It's kind of the impression you get if you read it here. Well, how many times has Matthew mentioned Nazareth so far in his narrative before this? That I know of. So his readers don't know that Jesus came from Nazareth to start with. That's where Jesus didn't come there, but where Mary and Joseph were. So he's just putting it back in Nazareth to get the setting there. Luke has already referred to Nazareth 2 or 3 times, so he says they returned to Nazareth. Now, I can't sit here and tell you why Luke left out the wise man and the trip to Egypt. Didn't include those in his narrative. I can't tell you why Matthew left out the angels and the circumcision and the purification of the temple, Simeon and Anna. I don't know. They were writing to different audiences. Maybe since Matthew is writing to a Jewish audience, he just assumed that they would know that the circumcision and the offering for purification took place. So it was just a common thing for Jews to do. Yes, Grant, help me out. Sure. Sure, I mean, yes. Right. We know this is all control of the Holy Spirit. Luke is writing to one audience, person. Matthew's writing to a different one, different approach. Fortunately for us, what do we have? We have them all. We live them side by side and piece it together and look at it that way. But it's just a difference in there. So why one put in one other than the, like Brent says, the direction from the Spirit? I don't know. Okay, so now he's back in Galilee and Nazareth for both of them. So for Egypt, he goes back, and I've got a little circle. It's kind of hard to see. That little red circle at the very top up there is Nazareth. Now, we'll jump forward in time. We don't know exactly how old Jesus was when the wise men came and the flight to Egypt, how long he stayed in Egypt when he came back. So we don't know how much time exactly has passed here between the time he came back and settled down in Nazareth until now he's going back from 12 years old. The day's 12, he is going back with his parents to the Passover feast. Now, there are three feasts, and we'll talk about these some more in a minute toward the end a little bit. There are three feasts that all Jewish males were required to attend every year. That means three trips to Jerusalem every year. Feast of Tabernacles, Feast of Weeks, which is also called Pentecost, and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Passover, which is one that's involved here. And it's talked about in Deuteronomy 16. We'll look at that verse here just in a minute and see more about these. But these three feasts they had to go to. So it's the Feast of Passover. So Jesus is going up with his parents to the Feast of Passover. And it lasted several days. And they get ready to, and they start home. And you all know this story. They get ready to start back home. And they're traveling probably in a group going back. Thinking about them maybe winding down through that road from Jerusalem to Jericho that Trent talked to us about the other day. Big group of them. Winding down through those hills, and they got down to a point, it's time to camp or for the night or something. They tried to find Jesus, but they can't find him. They thought he might have been with some of the people. So they have to turn around and go back to Jerusalem, try to find him. It took them 3 days to locate him. And when they got back, they found him in the temple. He was asking and answering questions. And that last line up there is kind of small type, sitting back here. But those who spoke with him were amazed at his understanding. 12 years old. He's speaking with those who will be much older and versed in the law and so. And they're just amazed at what he knows and how he answers and asks questions. So, look at verse 48. What's the question the parents ask? What do they say? Somebody? Yeah. Why'd you do this to us? Who are they looking at? Why'd you do this to us? We already left. We've gone a whole day's, this is walking now, about a whole day's journey, but it turned around, come back, left the crowd we was traveling with, 3 days looking for you. Why'd you do this to us? What's verse 49 say? What's his answer? I must be about my father's business. Don't you know that I must be about my father's business? Now, I don't know if this is the first time he had made a comment like this to them about this special relationship here. We'll talk about that, my father's business here in a minute. Kind of hone in on it a little bit. Let's right now jump across it and come back to it. So he returned to Nazareth. He was subject to his parents. Then he grew in these four ways that you've heard sermons about and talked about. In wisdom, stature, favor with God, and favor with man. So he grew mentally, physically, spiritually, and socially is the way that it's generally laid out. A complete package, if you will, as he grew and matured. The next thing we're going to see, of course, another big advance until we get down to where he's come for baptism. This is age 12. All right, a couple points. The scholars in the temple were amazed at what he was saying. Mary still is, several times it's said, she keeps these things in her heart, thinking about them. She doesn't understand all this that's going on. I mean, all the way back from the angel appearing, and you'll be deceived by the Holy Spirit, and then all these things that have happened. I mean, I'm sure it'd be perplexing. Now, the next 18 years, from time he's 12 to age 30, they're going to pass, and there's no scripture. We have nothing about him from now till he comes to be baptized with John when he's 30 years old. And as far as we know, Joseph, once this point here at age 12 is not mentioned again. So we don't know what happened to Joseph, how long he lived. Later we'll get Jesus' mother and brethren, but nothing's ever said about Joseph again. Okay. Let's look at John chapter 1 for a few minutes. John chapter 1. We talked last time about John. John himself and who he was. We haven't talked about the text. We've looked at Luke and Matthew mostly now. So let's look at John chapter 1. And let's read together the first 18 verses of this. 18 verses of Luke chapter 1. Think about John now, how he starts off and how he deals with all this compared to what Luke and Matthew have done. Okay. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and darkness did not comprehend it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all through him might believe. He was not the light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man who comes into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, to those who believe in his name. We were born, not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh, and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, the glory as the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness of him, and cried out, saying, "This is he of whom I said, he who comes after me is preferred before me, for he was before me. In all of his fullness, we have all received grace for grace. For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him." We could spend a lot of time talking about John chapter 1. A lot of things that are said here. That if we've been through classes in John, we take time just to detail out these verses. There's so much said the way John starts off here. He was in the beginning. He was God. Was with God. Was God. You might say he is God. Became flesh. Dwelt among people. We've already talked about the birth. All things are made through him. Without him, nothing was made. Jesus was in the beginning with God. He was in creation. He made things. In him was life. John was not the light. It's John the Baptist or John the Baptist, John the Forerunner, not John the wrote the book John here. He came to his own. He came to his own people. Don't think they received it. even though the prophecies had pointed to him. He would give the right to become children of God to those who received him, those who believe on his name. To bring grace and truth. It's getting a lot of John here. It's on the thing on the screen up here. Matthew and Luke both give genealogies of Christ. We're not talking about those very much. Here's a comment. Generally, we think about one of us as genealogy through Joseph, the other one's genealogy through Mary. I think this comment here was interesting. He says, most interpreters have supposed that Matthew gives the genealogy of Joseph, and Luke gives that of Mary, going back to David, farther back. They both descended from David, but in different lines. One came through Solomon, one came through the son, David's son Nathan. The solution derives some plausibility from the fact that the promise was made to David, and that Jesus was not the son of Joseph, basically. It was important to show that Mary was also descended from him. Though the solution is plausible and may be true, yet it wants evidence, according to this writer here. You cannot have it be proved that that was not the design of Luke. He's just raising a question in his mind about what that was all about there. But as you look at the genealogy, Matthew goes through Joseph and through Solomon. Luke comes in through Nathan and down through Mary's descendants. Both of them coming down from Joseph, from David. Okay. Names for Jesus. We've talked about several names already that he's been called. Emmanuel, God with us. Christ, which means the anointed one. He's being referred to as Lord, which is his supreme being, eternal being. So some of the names we'll get more later on as we go through it. Said some of the ones already. Okay. Just for thinking a little bit. Talk about the three feasts where all the men are to go together before God, presently before God. Here's that verse in Deuteronomy. Three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord. So they were all to come together at the temple before it had been the tabernacle. They would appear before the Lord at these three feasts, all the males. Okay? The place which he shall choose. He names the feast, unleavened bread, feast of weeks, the feast of tabernacles. I think what he says, this I thought was kind of interesting. They shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. The three times a year they come in before the Lord, but when you come, you don't come empty-handed. Verse 17. Every man shall give as he is able, according to how you've been blessed, what God has given you. Can you think of anything? Anything roll through your mind that might be kind of like that for us? Click. Come on, click. Battery's dead. All right. 1 Corinthians 16. How are you going to give? As you're able, as you've been prospered. 2 Corinthians, he says, according to your ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were willing to give. Nothing new. I mean, look what he said back here to these people back in Deuteronomy 16. When you come before me, don't come empty-handed. You've been blessed. You've been blessed. I like it. Give something back to me. Same type thing we give. And then, of course, we all know the verse here in 31 where the widow cast in her two mites and she had given all that she had. So, what are we going to do when we come before the Lord? What's the teaching for us? Well, across this verse back in Deuteronomy 16, and he stood and said, don't come empty-handed. When you come before me, you bring something. You bring me something based on how you've been blessed. What do you expect of us? We've come before him. He's blessed us. What do you want back from us? You bring me something based on how you've been prospered. Okay, thoughts on those lines, comments? All right, I got one more. Jesus said, I must be about my Father's business. Look at some reading about it, a better translation, they say, might be, I must be in my Father's house, which would be where he was in the temple when they found him. And this is the point I want you to say about my Father. The term he used here was obviously about my Father's business or my Father's house. It's the same phrase, same wording, as I understand from what I read about the original language. But he said, I go to my brethren and say to them, or you go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father, to your Father, and to my God and your God. When Christ was going back, was ascending back to heaven, where was he going? He was going back to his Father. That's that same term, that same Father he's talking about here when he used it, when he said, I'm about my Father's business. Okay. Now, this commentator here wrote this. Tending to the things of his Father was not only his duty, it was a natural part of his very being. He desired it. He loved it. It grew out of a deep personal consciousness of his kinship with Almighty God. He was his Father. Like Jesus, we should know that one's private relationship with the Father is fostered by spiritual worship and study in the house of God. Back to our points about the three feasts. Why were they to come together? They should all appear before me three times a year. It's important that they do that. But the rest of this verse, or just this commentator, says, and the most important business for us is to be about our Father's business. Jesus took a very personal relationship between himself and his Father. The same personal relationship we need to have between us and our Father. And therefore, because of that relationship, what do you do? I must be about my Father's business. I got things to do. Why? Because of who he is, my relationship with him. So what am I going to do? I have things to do. Why? Well, he's my Father. I got things to do because he is this. Thoughts from anybody? Physical Father, yeah.
He says, there's his Father, loving Father. So where did you go? He says, I must be about my Father's business.
Whole different relationship or something like that. I don't know how many, times he went, but yeah, you understand your point. Three times a year for, you know, all these years. Yeah. And that's why I put this point up here about and showed the Father here. We get that relationship. You know, that's what might, it's not his earthly Father he's talking about. I'm going to be about my Father's business. Which Father? The one I'm going to send back to. The one I'm going back to be at his right hand. That's the Father he's talking about. My Father's business. Anybody else? Thoughts? I got much more for you. Okay, one more point here. We talked about Herod the Great. He's the one who was alive when Jesus was born. He's the one going to try to kill all the children. We talked about his son Archelaus, He's the one that took Herod's spot when Herod died. So Joseph comes back and hears he's reigning, so he don't want to be there, so he goes back to Nazareth. Now in the next lesson, we've got two more. We're going to pick up Herod Antipas and Philip. They'll be in Luke chapter 3. We're going to see their names pop in there. So we're going to start picking up more of these names in this Herod family here. So Herod the Great is out of the picture now. Archelaus, that one time mentioned, he's out of the picture now. But we will get Herod Antipas and Philip when we get into Luke chapter 3. That's it. 3 minutes short. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, okay, right. I can't recap all that, but basically, if you didn't hear what Rebecca was saying, we pointed out already the difference between the first four verses of Luke and who he's writing to and why he's writing and all these. He said, I've got everything in order. I've talked to the witnesses, and that's the point she's making here. Luke is laying out things in order exactly over here, and he's got all the people involved in it. He's got the witnesses he's bringing in with Simeon and Anna and the different ones that's involved. John, the Baptist, talked about more there. Matthew is writing for different things. We talked about, remember, Jesus Christ is used three times in Matthew chapter 1. He is what he's proclaiming, the coming of the Messiah. To who? To the Jewish people. That's who he wrote to. He's writing to the Jews for that purpose. Luke is doing a whole different thing. He's trying to lay all this eyewitness account out, Theophilus, who knows nothing about the whole thing. He's writing to him. So it's a whole different approach to what they're doing and the people they're writing to and their approach that they're writing to. That's somewhere close. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much.